It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farish. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says the high price tag on college is putting the dream of a college education out of reach for many students and families. We'll find out what she says needs to change.
First, millions of people across the country tuned in to watch presidential hopefuls Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump meet head-to-head in the first debate before the general election.
You're telling the enemy everything you want to do.
No, we're not.
See, you're
no,
telling the not. Enemy everything we you want to do. No wonder you've been fighting.
We have to do a much better job at keeping our jobs.
Donald thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I think it's real.
I do not say.
I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted.
He has really started his political activity based on this racist lie that our first black president was not an American citizen.
I think my strongest asset, maybe by far, is my temperament.
And you know what else I prepared for? I prepared to be president, and I think that's a good thing.
Joining us now to talk about the debate is Susan Johnson. She's associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Whitewater and director of UW-Whitewater's Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, with the basic civics assumption that a debate is supposed to inform voters about what a candidate would do if elected, how they would do it, was this debate, by that standard, successful?
I would have to say no. If we put it up against previous presidential debates that I've watched over the course of the time that I've watched debates, which is quite a while, and I recall those debates being much more substantive and both candidates in those instances articulating in a much more developed way policy proposals. We didn't necessarily see that last night.
Why? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that for a couple of reasons. I think the primary reason would be that we haven't seen much of that from Donald Trump at all in terms of putting forward what we would traditionally consider policy position papers and things like that. There's some information that he's provided, but not to the extent that we have come to see other presidential candidates do in the past. So I think that that would be the main reason. And I think that while Hillary Clinton has done quite a bit more of that, when the debate took on such an uncivil, you use the word civic, such an uncivil tone so early on, I think that that dominated more so than substantive policy discussions.
So apart from policy, we get to see how a candidate behaves on a high-profile stage. Did we learn anything about the candidates and how they presented themselves, how they answered questions, how they dealt with attacks from the other candidate?
Well, I think that's a really important point. I think that many people would argue that the debates are less about policy and more about temperament, let's say. And some people tuning in who haven't necessarily been paying as much attention throughout the course of the campaign season, tuning in a meaningful way to see the two people who are vying for their vote to be president of the United States. And in that regard, I think last night we got a window into the temperament of both of the candidates. And I think if we're looking for differentiations, I would argue that Hillary Clinton was much more moderate in her temperament, let's say. And she was somewhat aggressive when Trump was aggressive. So there was a bit more back and forth than, again, I think what we expect. But I think that in terms of being quite aggressive, Donald Trump was quite aggressive in terms of interrupting Hillary Clinton while she was speaking and then interjecting with comments as she was speaking or going to the moderator in a way that I think isn't expected.
I wonder how much this matters. We hear sometimes in the past, oh, debates, sometimes they're a turning point, sometimes they're a momentary blip. On the other hand, this one, we know at least 80 million people watch this thing, and that's preliminary numbers, a lot not counted in that. That doesn't account people who, like me, listened at WPR.org. I'll put in a plug. Susan, is this one going to be a difference maker?
You know, I think it's hard to tell right now whether or not it's going to be a difference maker. I think in the run-up to debates, there's a lot of attention paid to how this could be a game changer, and there are historical examples where we've seen debates have a significant impact. But I think that what we really need to do is step back. Some of the snap polls showed that Hillary Clinton was determined to be the winner by the people who were polled, and some of those polls varied quite a bit. But I think that we need to wait and see what some of the new polling looks like as it comes out in the week, you know, following this debate. Traditionally, the first debate is the most watched debate, so I would argue that it's probably the most important debate moving forward. I think we need to just look at, give it some time to sink in and see if it moves the polls.
We're talking to political scientist Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater, looking at last night's debate. You can share your reactions on the Central Time Facebook page or give a call, 800-642-1234. Let's get into some of the issues that came up. They both presented their thoughts on jobs, the most important things to do about jobs and the economy in the country. We'll start with a listen to Hillary Clinton. She wanted to build an economy, she said, for people across the country, not just at the top.
We need new jobs, good jobs, with rising incomes. I want us to invest in you. I want us to invest in your future. That means jobs in infrastructure, in advanced manufacturing, in innovation and technology, clean renewable energy, and small business, because most of the new jobs will come from small business. We also have to make the economy fairer. That starts with raising the national minimum wage and also guarantee, finally, equal pay for women's work.
So do you see this as something that's appealing to the Democratic base, Bernie Sanders supporters, or is this a generally appealing message maybe to the undecided voters, whoever they may be?
I think you could pick that apart and see that there was something for everyone that she's hoping to attract. So you have things about bringing back manufacturing jobs, which would be important. She had a comment about technology infrastructure. She talked about equal pay for equal work. So I think that that was one of those catch-alls where she tried to hit on all the key constituencies for the Democratic Party, and then also thinking about a key swing group, for example, suburban, moderate suburban women who are going to be an important group in this election, who have sometimes voted for the Republican candidate. So I think she hit a lot of the key demographics.
Now here's Donald Trump talking about jobs and trade.
We have to stop our jobs from being stolen from us. We have to stop our companies from leaving the United States and with it firing all of their people. All you have to do is take a look at Carrier Air Conditioning in Indianapolis. They left, fired 1,400 people. They're going to Mexico. So many, hundreds and hundreds of companies are doing this. We cannot let it happen. Under my plan, I'll be reducing taxes tremendously from 35% to 15% for companies, small and big businesses.
So kind of combining two different platforms. He was talking elsewhere about trade and trade agreements, attacking Hillary Clinton on that. And then this corporate tax cut, that is more in the mainstream of Republican Party thinking than his anti-trade message. What did you think of what he had to say about jobs?
Yeah, that's really interesting because you're right. He's pitching two different messages simultaneously. He's pitching the strong anti-free trade agreement, which has a core of support in the Democratic Party and would also have a core of support in certain pockets of the Republican Party. But then at the same time, he's talking about those big tax cuts for what would be larger corporations. So he's really pitching at those two different groups. And I think when it comes to the issue, particularly of trade, I think that's one of the spots last night where I think he did well, because it's an issue when he spoke against TPP and went after Hillary Clinton for her support of that. And I think that that was one of the places where he scored points.
We're talking about last night's presidential debate. Susan Johnson is with us. She's associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Whitewater.
And we want to hear from you on this. What is your reaction to last night's debate? If you're on the fence, did either candidate make a strong case to win your vote? Or if you've already planned to vote for one of the candidates, did either of them sway you in their direction a little bit? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're taking a look at last night's presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
And we'd like to hear from you. What moments stood out to you last night in the debate? Did it help you maybe make a decision if you hadn't done so already? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Susan Johnson is with us. She's associate professor and chair of political science at UW-Whitewater and director of UW-Whitewater Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research.
And we'll go to our callers now. Eric is with us in Beloit. Eric, hi.
Good afternoon. The thing that I found particularly interesting was the comments leading up to the debate about fact-checking, because we know, politicians occasionally in the heat of the moment may pull some statistic or fact out of the air, and in this particular case, although they didn't do it on the main programming last night, they did do it on Bloomberg. And I was wondering if there was anything that your guest had heard about the effects of that and the discussion about how, the fact-checking of the particular statements had gone.
Eric, thanks for that call. Yeah, Bloomberg, NPR had record, I guess, page views for their live fact-checking. There's talk of, should Lester Holt be fact-checking? Should the candidates? Hillary Clinton kept mentioning fact-checking. Talk about the role of this whole wave of fact-checking going on, Susan.
Yeah, this is a newer phenomenon over just the course of the last few presidential election cycles where we have this idea of fact-checking. And you're right. I was just perusing the New York Times fact-checking before going on the air with you this afternoon, and I know that NPR was doing it, as you said, and others, and Hillary Clinton made a pitch for people to go to her website to see how they were going to be fact-checking Donald Trump's statements. You would think that given the heightening now of this role of fact-checkers, that candidates would know that that's happening and maybe tamp down some of the things that they say. And I don't know. I haven't seen any research that's shown that to be the case or not. I do know that speaking about last night, Donald Trump, several of the fact checkers pointed out that there were things that he said that were not true, which in fact had been shown that he said before. And the Iraq War debate came up again, a comment about global warming in China that then was traced back to a tweet that he had put out there a couple years ago. Hillary Clinton had she'd referenced TPP as being the gold standard of trade agreements, and that turned out to, in fact, be – Donald Trump brought that up, and that turned out to, in fact, be true. So I don't know to what extent fact-checking might make a difference in terms of what people say. I didn't see that it made a difference, at least in terms of what Donald Trump said. And you'd have to go back and kind of compare Hillary Clinton and fact-checking earlier to kind of, do an accurate analysis, I would say.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Pat on the line in Milwaukee. Pat, hi.
Hey. I think overall Hillary Clinton is probably is a little bit more composed, clearly knows more about the issues, which is important. However, I would say this. I think when Donald Trump said, same old politician, sounds good, won't work, hasn't happened, I think that's a pretty powerful line because it's true. In the past, every 4 years, we hear the same things. We talk about the same issue. It's the same talking points from Republicans and Democrats every 4 years, and nothing ever changes. And I think the mistake the media and some of the pundits are making is they're so concerned about Donald Trump's exact words and his rhetoric, and they're not taking him seriously, and they're not looking at the entire message where a lot of us are not as concerned about every single word he says, and we don't try and look at it from all different angles, but he sounds different. He's saying things differently, and we can kind of see the larger thing that he's trying to get at. And, yeah, it doesn't sound great. He's not a politician, but I think we're kind of sick of politicians, and that's why this race is so close.
Pat, thanks for that call. And Susan, I think he summed up really well probably the arguments on both sides of the race here. But Donald Trump's appeal, he sounds different. He's different, and people are fed up with the politicians they've seen before.
Oh, I agree with Pat. And I think that people who discount Trump because of how he speaks or what he says it's dangerous in the sense of if you're a Democrat and you're discounting that, or the pundits shouldn't be discounting that. I mean, he is the nominee of a major political party. I think part of the reason why some Republicans who are upset that he's the nominee are upset at themselves because they sort of let that happen and didn't recognize the fact that what he was saying was resonating with a lot of people for just the reasons that Pat raised. He isn't speaking like a politician, and there's this great distrust in much of America for politicians, and we have a Congress that's deadlocked, and so people are looking for someone who might come in and really, really shake things up, not just a little bit, but a lot, and for many people, he's the person to do it.
Pat, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Glenn in Blue Mounds. Glenn, hi.
Hi there. One of the comments I would have, first of all, I could only listen on the radio, so I was more nuanced to the vocal part. And when Donald interjected over Hillary's comments about him not paying any taxes for a decade or something, and he said, just because I'm a smart. Well, in other words, he said that anybody who pays their taxes is stupid.
Glenn, thanks for the call. Let's give a listen, actually, to that moment, that exchange here.
The only years that anybody's ever seen were a couple of years when he had to turn them over to state authorities when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. So
that makes
if
me
he's
smart.
Paid zero.
And Susan, I saw something about a focus group with undecided voters where they said there was an audible gasp in the room at that comment. Is that something that is going, if, to the extent people key in on particular things, is that something that you think could sway voters?
That's really interesting. The idea that he might not be paying taxes and he put out there that that would be, you know, a smart thing to do. You know, I don't know. I think that most people, even people who don't like the idea of paying taxes, understand that there's a need to pay taxes for things like police and schools and things like that. And so, you know, I would think that that would come be perceived more negatively than positively.
Thanks for the call. We're talking about last night's presidential debate with Susan Johnson, political scientist from UW-Whitewater. Back to our callers now. Lori is on the line in Rudolph. Lori, hi.
Hi. I would just like to say last night's debate was a little disappointing on both sides. Sure, Hillary Clinton came off very polished, and Donald Trump needs to go home and basically practice and learn a little bit more on facts. The thing is they diverted away from all of the questions about what their plans were. We never heard any concrete plan that they had. It was more of the childish high school picking on each other going on, and I don't think America can make a educated vote listening to either one of them last night on what we should bring this country to being.
Lori, thanks for the call. And yeah, a lot of people have remarked on the amount of time spent not answering the questions Lester Holt was asking, Susan.
Well, I think it was that. And I also think that sometimes some of the questions that were asked didn't get to the kinds of things that Lori wanted to hear. So beyond some of the childish bickering, I think some of the questions that came nearer the end weren't necessarily substantive policy issues. I think they're things that Lester Holt felt he had to address. Comments that Donald Trump had made, comments that Hillary Clinton had made, but those were clearly not substantive policy questions. In the next debate, it's a town hall forum, and from what I understand, people are able to submit questions ahead of time, voters are, and so maybe there'll be more substantive questions in that debate, but I think that Lori, you know, hit on something with the lack of specific policy discussions.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lori. Let's give another listen now. Both candidates were asked about race. They talked about race, crime, and policing, kind of lumped a lot of things in together. First, we'll listen to Hillary Clinton on this.
Unfortunately, race still determines too much, often determines where people live, determines what kind of education in their public schools they can get, and yes, it determines how they're treated in the criminal justice system. We've just seen those two tragic examples in both Tulsa and Charlotte. And we've got to do several things at the same time. We have to restore trust between communities and the police. We have to work to make sure that our police are using the best training, the best techniques, that they're well prepared to use force only when necessary. Everyone should be respected by the law, and everyone should respect the law.
Hillary Clinton on police community relations there. Let's go right to Donald Trump.
We have to bring back law and order. Now, whether or not in a place like Chicago you do stop and frisk, which worked very well, Mayor Giuliani is here, it worked very well in New York, it brought the crime rate way down. But you take the gun away from criminals that shouldn't be having it. We have gangs roaming the street, and in many cases, they're illegally here, illegal immigrants, and they have guns, and they shoot people. And we have to be very strong, and we have to be very vigilant. We have to know what we're doing. Right now, our police, in many cases, are afraid to do anything. We have to protect our inner cities because African-American communities are being decimated.
So, Susan, we heard law and order there, change in the way we police from Hillary Clinton. Hot issues now. What did you make of the back and forth there?
Well, I think it was an interesting response from Hillary Clinton in regard to, I wouldn't say interesting, I would say it was a very measured response to a very tough issue. As far as Donald Trump, he's been talking about stop and frisk quite a bit recently. It's come up and it's been one of the things that he's been advocating for. And talking about law and order, and that was a big theme of his convention, so he's sticking with that theme. But I think that there's broader issues that we need to hear the candidates address when it comes to matters of race, and it's more, obviously, as we know, than just these issues related to crime, as Donald Trump was referencing it.
We'll leave it there for now, Susan. Thank you so much. We'll call you back again to look more at this presidential race as it continues.
Sounds great. Thanks, Rob.
Been talking to Susan Johnson, Associate Professor and Chair of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, Director of the UW-Whitewater Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. Been talking about last night's debate, and by the way, tune in tomorrow at this time. Harry Enten from 538.com is going to be back with us, try to figure out how we'll know how this debate has affected the presidential race.
Coming up after the news, our guest says the dream of a college education is slipping out of reach for an increasing number of students and their families. We'll find out why. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, it may be difficult for people looking to get pregnant to get tested for the Zika virus. A doctor tells us why that is and what you can do if you think you might have been exposed to the mosquito-borne virus.
First, getting a college degree is still seen as a ticket to a better life. Higher wages, middle-class status, and opportunity. It's part of the American dream. But for some students from disadvantaged backgrounds and even students from financially stable families, that dream is slipping out of reach as college costs go up and wages go down or stagnate.
In her new book, Higher Education Policy, Professor Sarah Goldrick-Rabb shares the results of a multi-year study that tracked 3,000 students enrolled in public colleges and universities in Wisconsin in 2008. The students were all getting financial aid in the form of Pell Grants or federal aid. Over the course of 6 years, half of them dropped out. Less than 20% finished within 5 years. She says the problem is clear. College is too expensive.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is with us now. She's the founding director of the Wisconsin Hope Lab and a professor of higher education and sociology at Temple University. Her new book is called Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Well, I want to start with the 3,000 students that you studied over 6 years, and this was when you were a professor here at the UW-Madison. Tell us about these students and why you chose them.
Well, all of these students began college in 2008. It was September, and they had graduated from high school, and they had decided that college would be an important part of their futures. And so they enrolled at one of the UW system institutions, which could include the colleges, and or they also enrolled in one of the Wisconsin technical colleges across the state. So they were attending the 42 public colleges and universities of the great state of Wisconsin. And all of these people also did something else that really, frankly, takes a lot of hard work, as families know, which is that they filed the FAFSA, which is the application for student aid. And what that information on that form indicated was that their family needed help when it came to paying for college. And they were very fortunate because at the same time, John and Tasha Morgridge, who people in Wisconsin know well as some outstanding philanthropists, they were also looking to make paying for college easier for some kids from Wisconsin families. And all of the people in this study met the criteria for that special new program, which is now known as the Fund for Wisconsin Scholars. And so they became part of a study that I led that was an effort to find out how that program and others like it do in terms of serving those students and helping them succeed.
And can you introduce us to a couple of them? You got to know some of them pretty well. This is over the course of 6 years. Tell us about maybe one or two.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we got to know them by interviewing them, looking at their data, but also by talking to them. And I'll tell you one story about a woman named Chloe, who I actually met for the first time in Madison. And Chloe had grown up in the middle of the state in a town that was mainly centered on a sawmill. And the year that she graduated from high school, the mill closed. And the economics of the town were not great. And Chloe thought it was probably time to go. Her parents had also recently gotten divorced. And when she thought about what she wanted to do, what she decided was she really loved animals. And it wasn't a coincidence that Chloe had grown up around horses and actually was fortunate enough to have a horse of her own. So she decided that she wanted to become a veterinary technician's assistant. She didn't want to be in charge. She just wanted to do some good in the world. And so she went off to a technical college, and she enrolled and filled out that aid application. And lo and behold, it revealed that her family's financial circumstances were weak enough that she would qualify for the federal Pell Grant. But the problem is that even though she got the federal Pell Grant and she got a little bit of state grant money as well, she faced a price of college that was well beyond her reach. The government estimated that her family could contribute a little over $2,000 to college, yet the college presented her with a bill that even after all the grants and scholarships were done was over $10,000 for a single year. And while we might think this is uncommon, especially for two-year college students, it's not. She's actually very similar to the national average.
I want to talk about those Pell Grants you mentioned, because in the past it used to be that the Pell Grants did end up covering most of the need for students who couldn't pay the full tuition. And it seems as though that the model has shifted or the economics have shifted of college. Tell us about how Pell Grants have functioned then and now.
Well, Pell Grants were designed to ensure that families like those that Chloe grew up in didn't have to take out any loans for college. The Pell Grant was supposed to cover everything. And back when the program began in the early 1970s, it covered the price of attending a two-year college fully. And it covered about three-quarters of the cost of attending a public four-year institution. Today, as you suggested, the purchasing power, the value of that grant has eroded so that it only covers about a third of the cost of attending a public four-year institution and about 60% of the cost of attending a two-year college. And one of the reasons is that the states have not continued to join the federal government in financing higher education. They pulled back on many of their resources, forcing the price of college at the state institutions up, driving up tuition. And as a result, even though the federal government has modestly increased the maximum Pell from year to year, it's basically buying less and less. It's like you bought a Groupon, but the value of that Groupon for the restaurant you want to go to is deteriorating by the day. So that by the time you actually use it, it's really not paying for much.
We always hear about how college is so expensive today. How much more expensive today is it than it used to be maybe in the 80s or 90s?
Yeah, it's substantial. substantially more expensive. You know, I profiled these students and I looked back. You know, they were 18 years old when they started in 2008, and they faced out-of-pocket costs for families making less than $25,000 a year. People were being left with bills that were over $10,000 a year at state institutions. And if they had gone to college the year that they were born, which was primarily around 1990, that price would have been very close to zero. So things have changed a ton, and it has to do with states pulling back on what they will pay on a per-student basis for college and the failure to continue to increase spending on need-based financial aid as more and more people have needed it.
We're talking with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb right now. You might remember her as a professor from the UW-Madison, and she's talking about research that she did here at in Wisconsin at the UW. Now she's at Temple University, where she's a professor of higher education, and her new book is out. We're talking about that right now. It's called Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. And Sarah, one thing you get into is what happens to these students when they don't have the money to make ends meet to pay for, you know, not just the tuition, but the things that go along with living, things like food and book costs and maybe supporting their families. What happens to these students, some of them?
Well, this was one of the hardest parts about this study. I had sent students, graduate students, out to do some of the interviews, and one of them came back to me in the fall of 2008, and she says, I don't know what to do. She said, I met a student today, and I asked her how college was going. I asked her what her biggest challenge was. And the student, who was 18 years old, turned to her, and she said, eating. My biggest challenge is eating. I don't have enough food to eat, and I can't focus on school. And that was the moment when my research team realized that so much of this country was missing the real picture by talking about tuition. The cost of living in this country is substantial, and college students, some of them, are going without their basic needs met. We've explored this further beyond Wisconsin since that time in several studies, and it is very clear that hunger and homelessness are not strangers to undergraduates now, which is really pretty devastating.
And you also point out that the financial aid formula for things like the Pell Grant, it assumes that money is moving from families to students, but sometimes the students are the one who are helping to support the family.
That's right. You know, Wisconsin's got a lot of wonderful families that work together to stay together and make ends meet, and so do people all over the country. But the financial aid system is remarkably presumptuous. It produces this expected family contribution, which assumes that your parents are going to give you resources. But in many cases, to make ends meet, students have been working to support their families even while in high school. And when they go to college, they keep doing the same thing. Their parents worked hard to get them to college, and they repay them even when they're trying to buy books and things by sending them bits and pieces of money or sometimes paying bills. And, you know, it puts the students in a really difficult situation. At the same time that they're happy to do it, it means they often go without the things they actually need.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is with us right now. She's the author of the book Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. She's a professor of higher education policy at Temple University.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you hearing your story, your family's story right now? Is a college education within reach for your kids when it comes to the price tag? What solutions would you like to see to make college affordable for more people? To make it affordable, maybe for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And Sarah Goldrick-Rabb stays with us. She's the author of the new book, Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. She did a lot of research for this book in Wisconsin at UW-Madison. And she's a professor of higher education policy right now at Temple University. And she says the price tag on a college degree, college education, is getting out of reach for growing numbers of Americans, and it's time to make a change.
We want to hear your story at 800-642-1234. How is your family working to pay for higher education, whether that's a university, a college, technical college? Is higher education out of reach for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Sarah, I want to get to our callers quickly, but before we do, can you tell us what you found? This was a study that took place over 6 years. What happened to these students who were receiving financial aid and Pell Grants?
Well, all of these students came to college to get some sort of credential, and only half of them did over the next 6 years. By a credential, I mean a certificate, an associate degree, or a bachelor's degree. And those who didn't, the vast majority of them, ended up in debt with nothing to show for it except that student loan bill that keeps coming due. And I think that's the hardest lesson of all from the study, is to watch people take a chance on getting an education only to find out they get nothing but somebody coming after them to collect.
I want to get to our callers now. We've got Paula first joining us in Appleton. Paula, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that, you know, in our family situation, it's going to be very challenging to help assist our kids go to college. We are both still dealing with our own student loan debt, which wasn't outrageous when we did it. We never took anything more than the minimum that we needed to get through. We both worked through our degrees. We both have jobs in our fields. Unfortunately, the jobs in our fields don't pay what our education actually costs. So for us, you know, and we remember eating crackers because there was no money for food. You know, we always had shelter, but our families, both of us were first generation. Our families did not have a lot to contribute. We really worked hard to get that education. We would love to be able to make that easier for our kids, and I don't know that having them have a debt-free education is necessarily the answer, but having them have an education where the debt is minimal, where they could at least still function post-graduation, because those entry-level jobs just don't pay what you go to school, what you pay tuition for.
Paula, thank you so much for calling and sharing what you went through and what you're thinking about for your kids. A couple of things that brought up, Sarah. One is, I'm curious about whether the jobs that are available when people do make it through college, if they match the debt load that they may have. And also, I wonder if we could start talking about some of the plans that are out there to change things. One of them, one possibility is debt-free college. What do you want to start with?
Well, the first thing is I want the caller to know that she's not alone in facing a difficult situation when the financial aid calculations don't even take into account your existing debt. It's really a remarkable thing when they size up your economic ability to pay for college and won't consider the debt you're already in from your prior education. I think it's also the case that, you should be able to major in something and take on as a career something that you love. And you shouldn't have to be so concerned that you make an enormous amount of money afterwards so you can pay off an enormous amount of debt. I agree with her. I don't know that the goal is to have no debt of any kind for anybody who attends a public institution. That's why I actually do prefer the framing, though, of saying, let's make the first couple of years, I call it the first degree, free. And the reason for that is that you ought to be able to get the associate degree under your belt so you know how to do college and you know what you're getting from it before you start taking on the risk involved of using debt to finance it. And that's what's changed over time. It used to be that if you were unsure or, not confident that your family could afford it, you could go to community college, go to a technical college, you could try it out, and if it didn't work, you would leave with no debt. That's over. There is no risk-free option anymore, and that's scary.
Why don't you like the idea of a debt-free college? Because I think a lot of parents, that sounds pretty appealing.
Sure, but the truth is, debt's a symptom. It's not the actual problem. So if you are somebody from a decent, from a family that's earning a decent income and you have a decent job, making minimal payments on a small amount of debt is entirely doable. It's much more important right now that we ensure that the folks who most can't handle the debt, like I said, the people on the lower income side of the distribution who are pursuing associate degrees, that they are able to go risk-free. And so while it sounds kind of funny, and I know how backwards this sounds, but that's because higher ed finance is so difficult and so complicated, it's actually the case that making a few years of college free is more targeted to those who really need it than debt-free for everybody is.
Paula, thanks a lot for calling. I really appreciate your story. And let's go next to Frank joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
What did you want to share?
Sure. So, you know, I had a similar experience to the previous caller. You know, I had to actually contribute a lot to my family while I was going to college. So a lot of the income that I was earning while in college was not going to pay for my tuition and my books and my food. It was actually going back home. And because of that fact, you know, I had to, you know, work sometimes two jobs during the semester to kind of try and take care of both things at the same time. And obviously that kind of leads to a cycle, not a positive cycle, right, that a normal student should be in when they're in college, let alone the trickle-down effect that ultimately led me to even have to take an additional year of college, which, you know, is kind of, you know, counterproductive in that sense. And, you know, I agree with also the previous comments when it came to financial aid calculation and FAFSA, because, it was my sense that the large majority of college students are really in that huge middle bracket where their family just literally made enough to survive. But because of that fact, you know, they're in a sense penalized and then have to contribute or held accountable to this larger tuition responsibility that they then have to carry on with them. And then, you know, that college debt is just simply not relative or manageable to the entry-level jobs and what they're paying. So,
Frank, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. Sarah, what strikes you about what Frank had to say?
Well, what strikes me, and Frank, thank you for sharing your story, because I have to tell you that a lot of students who are giving money to their families these days, frankly, are not talking about it. And to just let people know this is happening is important. This afternoon, I published a piece in The Atlantic about how the financial aid system betrays families, and it's all about these issues with a couple of stories from students in the book. And I just think it's so important that people start talking about this so that we can get rid of these stereotypes where everybody is just getting their mom and dad to pay for things.
Frank, thanks again for that. And Sarah, as we get close to the end of our time together, I want to catch up with a story you began with, a student named Chloe. What happened to her?
Yeah, well, things didn't work out so well. Unfortunately, you know, in order to pay those bills, she took on two jobs. She was working at Kohl's and PetSmart, and she tried to tighten her belt by living a little further from campus where things were cheaper and living with her boyfriend. She was commuting all over the place. There wasn't enough time in the day, and she started to do badly in school. She realized that. She knew she wanted to do better, so she tried to take on a student loan. It didn't arrive for a month and a half. And by that point, her grades had tanked. She was placed on academic probation, and she dropped out. And unfortunately, years later, she's never found her way back into college. She is one of those with debt and no degree. And now she's in the Navy. And, you know, she likes it a lot. She feels that she gets three square meals a day and a roof over her head, which she felt like being in college, she couldn't assure those things. So she feels better in that sense. But it's very, very clear she wants to go back to school, doesn't see a route. However, the University of Phoenix keeps calling her to talk about her GI benefits. And that's concerning for so many reasons.
Yeah, her story was striking to me because she kept coming back to getting 8 hours of sleep in the military. To be that happy about 8 hours of sleep,
mm-hmm,
lets you know that she wasn't sleeping a heck of a lot when she was
that's
trying
right
to go through school.
Yeah, it was very hard to watch.
So one of the things you say that gets at Chloe's story is that you want to make it easier for students to get money quickly to help them stay at school. Tell us about some of your ideas there.
Yeah, well, it's called emergency aid, and that's just a flexible aid that can be delivered fast and usually outside of the financial aid system. And I'm hoping your listeners will be interested in something. Since I left the University of Wisconsin, I've been thinking a lot about these students and everything that's going on in their lives. So I partnered with a couple of friends, and we made a new nonprofit, and we're actually running something now called the FAST Fund. And I staked it with 5% of my income now, and we're fundraising for more. And what we're doing is we're giving out emergency aid very quickly to students at three institutions to begin with. And those schools are Milwaukee Area Technical College, Bunker Hill Community College in Boston, and students in the Madison area, the public school district. And people can give to that. The way that the money is going to the students, though, is that instead of going to administrators at colleges, we're giving the money directly to teachers. And the teachers are the ones in the classrooms with the students who see these problems. So FAST, while it's quick, stands for faculty and students together. And this is just a small effort to try to prevent some of the damage that's happening when students really go without the resources they need.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate your time. That was Sarah Goldick-Rabb, the author of the book Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. A lot of the research for the book done in Wisconsin at UW-Madison. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. You can share your stories about paying for college on the Central Time Facebook page.
Today, for some reason, is National Chocolate Milk Day, a reminder of a beverage that I used to really like a lot, but now I just kind of forget about for the most part.
It's probably because you're over 12, but I think that when we do remember chocolate milk, when you do have it as an adult, it's pretty delicious, I have to say.
I haven't gone back and tried in a while. I mean, I guess there's a certain nostalgia factor, because I used to like the powdered stuff that was in that rectangular can, and you mix it up, or strawberry version, too. That was good,
yeah.
But that's not chocolate anymore, though I'd mix them. So you don't drink it anymore, though?
I do once in a while because my kids like it. Once in a while, I'll just get a hankering for chocolate milk. And I don't know if you saw, there was a study out, I think in the New York Times, I saw it about chocolate milk sort of being a good restorative after you worked out. So I thought, oh, hey, chocolate milk is a health food. And I was on board with that for a while.
I'd have to work out first. And you know this story. I'm very suggestible. One time I was here at work looking at something in a newspaper. Right, because we used to look at newspapers, and I was getting this urge, like, I haven't had chocolate milk in like 12 years, and I want some right now. Why is that? And I finally looked down below the fold, and there was this ginormous chocolate milk ad that I'd been subconsciously absorbing, and I had chocolate milk, and it was okay.
Fact check, I think it was a magazine you were looking
nope,
at,
because
you showed
it was a
me
newspaper.
The picture. All right, we're going to disagree about
agree
that.
To disagree.
But yes, chocolate milk is easily, it gets in your subconscious, and you just got to have some.
Oh.
I wonder how many people will have chocolate milk today after hearing this.
Not me, I'm going to resist.
All right, well, go have some chocolate milk or whatever you choose, and you're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.